Welcome to Season 7 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Daniel Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
There's three brand new games on AllPlay.com. First, there's French Toast, a new thinky party game from the Things and Rings designer Peter C. Hayworth, where you're going to guess the secret word by comparing it to French Toast. Then there's Torchlit, a unique trick-taker discovered at the 2024 Indie Night Market at PAX Unplugged, where you delve into dungeons to defeat monsters by the light of your torch. And last, but not least, there is High Society, a Knizia classic brought back to life with new art where you enhance your status via ostentatious expenditure but avoid scandal and shame. Check out these three games on AllPlay.com. Before we jump into today's episode, I want to remind everyone that Unpub Festival 2026 is coming March 12th through 15th over in the Baltimore area. If you haven't signed up, I highly recommend you do. If you want to know more about the convention, check out Hunter Nye's interview in the previous episode. But we do have some fun panels that were announced, such as the keynote, Fostering a Local Playtesting Community, Online Playtesting, a Crash Course in Game Manufacturing, Volunteering with Unpub, Design to Doorstep a Last Mile Perspective, Self-Publishing for Self-Starters, Pitch Better, What's Holding You Back from Getting You Pitched, Promoting Local Tabletop Economy, Designing Strategy Games from Entry Level to Euro Depth, Designing Party Games and Getting Them Published, and many more. And the best part is, you're going to hear from people like me, Elizabeth Hargrave, who did Wingspan, Scott Brady from Hughes & Q's, Connie Vogelman is going to be there as our keynote speaker, who created both Wormspan, Apiary, and has some other cool designs coming out in the future. So lots of big names, lots of interesting subjects. I highly recommend checking them out at Unpub Festival next month. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 135, Stable Times. Today we are joined by Christian Mott, the freelance game designer for Insectrum, Dinosaur Exhibit, and a lot of other games. I see that you have quite a few signed coming out in the future, so good for you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. No, I'm so excited to have you on. Our paths have crossed quite a few times. I feel like more digital than in person over the past few years, but it's been fun to see how you've evolved as a designer.
Yeah, I think the very first time I ever met you was I actually pitched you a game.
Wait, was that really the first where I saw your face?
I think so.
Oh, okay. Yeah, at Wise Wizard. Ooh, actually, from your perspective, how was I to pitch to?
Totally fine. Like, you were not intimidating, but also I felt fairly new enough that I was like, I hope she likes my stuff. But I felt like you gave really good constructive feedback, and we did implement those changes that you suggested.
Yeah, I know. That's cool that you ended up getting the game signed. Love to hear it. Well, for anyone who doesn't know you already, how did you start designing games?
Sure. So I started originally making games for my kids. Up until this year, I have been a full-time homeschool mom of three kids. The short story is I just started designing games for them sort of to supplement different things in homeschool. And through that, my husband and I discovered bigger games and we started playing, and things just sort of got out of control from there. It's like we started playing more games, I started making more games, and I couldn't stop. That sort of led me to where I am now.
That's so great. I remember when I was working at Underdog Games, so often I would be interviewing homeschool parents because that was a large amount of their audience, since the whole idea of Underdog was inspiring through curiosity. And it's true. Like, when I was in class, I always was more engaged if there was like a game or an activity versus just them going, meow, 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 kind of like a peanut parent.
Oh, yeah. It's so much more hands-on, and there's so much that kids are learning through games that you don't even realize. And you can't really quantify that. It's just, if you're playing a science game or whatever, you know, they're learning about science, but then there's decision-making, there's turn-taking, you know, if they're younger.
Mm-hmm. Being patient, waiting.
Yeah, just so many small little decisions that they're making that even if they talk to you about it later, like I said, you can't fully quantify what it is that they've learned. And, you know, it may not come up for years, or you may never know.
Oh, totally. I feel like adding an age onto a game especially is like hard when you're designing. You're like, yeah, you know, this seems easy, I'm gonna put this age. But it's not until you actually look into like child development or play test with kids or talk to parents or teachers that you realize, oh wait, any age under six actually isn't as dexterous with their hands as you'd imagine, so maybe this game doesn't actually work, or maybe they shouldn't be holding seven cards, let's reduce it to three. And it's like all these little choices that you don't think about.
Yeah, I think a lot of times, especially when I'm trying to put ages on my games, it's like, well, there's too much text, so it needs to be, you know, 8 and up or 10 and up, depending on how much text there is. But there's so many other little things in games that you kind of don't realize kids can enjoy, too. So it's, you know, oh, this age actually can play this game. And
yeah. And recognizing that we all have different education systems, depending on where we live and what schools we attend. I used to think I was really, really smart. Turns out, yeah, I was the smart of the average. Yes, I was ahead in math and I was ahead in like a ton of AP courses in Arizona. But as soon as I went to the Chicago area, I was like, oh no, I'm average. Or maybe I'm a little good at some things, but like really, I'm not that special, which was a good lesson to learn.
Well, I think that's a lesson that we all learn as we grow up. It's like, yeah.
Yep. Big fish, small pond.
Mm-hmm.
Then going to the ocean, you go, oh no. Very Finding Nemo as like, help, dad.
Yeah.
No, that's so cool. I'm glad that you were able to have that experience and transferable skills over. And I mean, also built-in playtesters. We love that.
Oh yes, which they were for a long time. And a lot of my early games I made based on things that they were into at the time. So like my very first game that I did was Dinosaur Exhibit, and I made that one because they were all into dinosaurs at the time, and the Spinosaurus, which is on the cover, was their favorite. So I built a whole game around the Spinosaurus being discovered, and they were playtesters for most of my games early on. Now they're older now, and they're like, I don't think I want to playtest a game that doesn't look like a real game, Mom.
Oh no, they got bougie.
Or they have better things to do.
Yeah, that's fair. Who wants to hang out with Mom when she's arts and crafting a game together?
I know. Well, it's interesting because like my oldest, he used to be my biggest playtester, and he playtested Dinosaurs, but I don't know how many times. But now it's my middle daughter who wants to play all the games. So I'll show her a prototype sometimes. I'm like, oh, let's try this one out. And she'll play it for 10 minutes and like, okay, give me a little bit of feedback. And then she's like, all right, Mom, I'm going to go make my own. I'll see you later. So she'll do her own thing based on what we had just played.
That's funny. She just like riffs off of you? Like, does she make a different version of the same game or does she make her own new game?
It depends. It depends kind of how the idea sparks. So sometimes she'll be like, I like this idea. I like these cards, but I'm going to make it about this, something different. Or she'll take that same idea and try to make her own. So like, interestingly enough, when I was working on Stable Times, she loves horses too. She would play the prototype sometimes, and then she would go and I would sign her into my Canva account, and she would just make cards. She would just find all the pictures or all the graphics of horses and just like make her own cards. And she would print out hundreds of them, cut them out. You know, sometimes the cards would do things, sometimes not. We went through a lot of cards at that point.
I'm hearing that, yeah. Got a subscription to Staples.
Yep.
That's so funny. That's really cool, though, that your kids were inspired to be involved. I mean, did you end up taking any of the cards that she made and put it into the actual game?
None of the cards that she made, although there is one card in the game, a horse named Henry. And so that is a horse that she loves. And she actually takes her lessons on that horse. He belongs to the barn where she goes and takes lessons. And so if you look at that card, it's her riding Henry.
Oh, I love that. So yeah, what inspired the design of Stable Times?
Stable Times itself has gone through quite the process. If you go really far back, it was originally, the idea came from a game that I had made. It was a party game about sea stars. So
okay,
bear with me. Basically, it was this interesting drafting mechanism where you were taking different colored sea star arms from the center of the table. They would clear out at some point, but you were basically just trying to be the first player to have 5 sea star arms of the same color, in that sea stars will grow their own arms like if they get cut off. And the game worked okay, and I took it to Geekway several years ago, and I played it with Devin Metlin and Andrew Stiles. They gave me some feedback on it, and I ended up turning it into more of a card game based on some of their feedback. Then it went through a few more stages, and it became a game about tattooing sea monsters. So basically you had these cards that you were playing out into columns, and so you wanted these tattoos to match, but you wanted each card had its own scoring condition as well. So you're trying to like lay them out in this grid and make the tattoos on the sea monster. And it stayed that way for a while, and I got it mechanically to where it was working and it was going very well. And then I thought, you know what? I've always wanted to make a horse game. Like, that has sort of always been this bucket list item for me because I was a horse person in the previous life. And so I just rethemed it. I tweaked a couple of things to make it more horsey rather than sea monsters with tattoos.
Sea monster tramp stamp.
And I pitched it to a couple of publishers in that stage as a horse game. And then I pitched it to Lovemore early last year, and they loved it. And so that's what we were working on all last year. And it just came out in November of 2025. Now it's 2026. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I was going to say we're in a new year. I know, it's wild. I've been doing the same thing. That is quite the thematic journey.
Yeah, it changed. It's much more thinky now than it was as the Starfish party game, which I could never really quite work through this sort of bottleneck situation that was happening with that game. Anyway, it's much better now than it was.
That's really cool. And I'm actually not super familiar with Lovemore Games. Could you tell me a little about them?
Sure. So it's run by Zach Lovelace, and they, it's a small family company, and they have done Jewel Box. They did that one in 2024. It was a game about beetles, which, interestingly enough, Jewel Box came out around the same time as Insectarium, which was my bug-themed game that I had with Snowbright. I always felt kind of bad because I saw that it came out at almost the exact same time, and I was so worried that they were going to be super similar.
Oh, like they might knock each other out or something?
Yeah, and they're not similar in gameplay at all. But we kind of had a good laugh about that because I had just cold emailed them to just see if they were taking pitches, because I always liked the feel of their games. It's just very family weight, very friendly, very bright. So I pitched it to them, and it's the first, Stable Times is the first game that they've done from an outside designer.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah. But they were wonderful to work with. Meg, their artist, did just phenomenal work with the horses. I love the art that she did for that.
Looks really cool. And how do you actually play the final version of Stable Times?
So it still has a similar drafting mechanism. So you have a hand of three horse cards, and you have this option where you can swap horses from the field. Whatever card you're swapping from your hand, you're putting on top of one of the three fields out there. So then anything underneath that card can't be taken, can't be drafted. And then you are playing up to two cards from your hand into your barn, and you're playing the cards in aisles. So the columns are aisles of stalls, essentially. Each aisle has to have it has to follow its own horse type. So there's a banner at the top of each card with an icon and a color. And so they all have to be that same type in that aisle. You can play up to two cards every turn. The two cards cannot be placed in the same aisle on the same turn. And you're also going for each card's own scoring condition based on where it's placed. Every barn board that you have in the game scores uniquely for different disciplines and different types of horses and card types. And so the game will end when one player has three completed aisles, meaning there's three cards in that aisle, but you can have up to 12 depending on how you play your cards. So it's always sort of a little bit of a race to how the game is going to end and if you're going to be able to fill all your aisles.
And what were the tweaks between the tattooing to this mechanically that got you to the current gameplay?
Yeah, there wasn't as much because the aisles were essentially arms of the monster. And so you were trying to tattoo similar tattoos on each arm, but then they sort of interacted with the different tattoos on other arms. So each card still had its own scoring condition.
Very interesting. It's always wild when themes are so different and then you're like, oh wait, but the gameplay is quite similar.
Right. Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot that changed, honestly, when it became horses. It's like, oh, well, yeah, you bring your horses back, putting them in stalls, in aisles, in your barn. That makes sense.
Totally makes sense. Yeah, we can't let them, like, roam free.
Yeah, so it ended up working out really well.
Yeah. How much playtesting was done in the development stage once the game was signed?
Quite a bit more, but it was really just small tweaks. I had spent a long time. So when it first went from the Starfish game to the Tattooing Sea Monsters game, there was a lot of playtesting that happened in that stage. So once it became the horse theme and it was in that stage, things moved fairly quickly. And once it was signed, we still did lots of tweaking and balancing and things like that for the different scoring conditions, but it wasn't a ton.
And how long do you think it took in total for that initial concept with the starfish up until it being published last November?
Oh my gosh, like in terms of hours?
You know, we can do like years. That's normally what people do. Yeah. You actually counted all your hours, I'd be so impressed.
I've never done that. Like, I would have no idea. So from conception as the Starfish game to when it was signed was 2.5 years, I think.
That's not bad. I mean, I feel like if you can get a game thought of and out in that 2 to 3 year range, that seems to be pretty average, at least after doing this podcast for over 130 episodes. It seems to be your kind of target range.
Yeah, and Lovemore, if we're talking about timelines, they are on it. Like, they were fantastic to work with. We signed it, I think, I want to say it was February of last year, and it came out in November.
Oh yeah, that is really good, especially for all the art that was involved.
Oh yeah, because every card has a unique horse on it, which, fun fact, they are all real horses. When they first announced the game, they put out an announcement on social media, like, if you have a horse or you know someone who has a horse who would like to have it on a card, you know, fill out this form and send in some photos and give us some information. And so every card in there is a real horse from a real person. Which I think is such a nice touch. One thing that I asked to do when we did sign it was, I had a horse too, she passed away several years ago. I had had her for almost 20 years of my life. So she had sort of seen me through all sorts of phases. And I really just sort of wanted her in the game. I wanted her as a card and on the cover. And they were like, oh yeah, no problem. So she's on the cover and she has a card in there as well. Her name is Dorothy. She's always my favorite card to play.
I love that. That's so cool that you were able to work and have input on the art, because I feel like that doesn't happen that often.
It doesn't. And they, you know, they wanted my opinion on a lot of stuff. And it's a very great working relationship. They were so willing to put Dorothy on the cover, and it meant so much to me.
Yeah, that is so nice. I'm lucky because my cats, they're all on Pack the Essentials and stuff since I developed the game with Jacqueline and like worked on designing the solo mode. So yeah, so I was like, oh, my babies, except my biggest baby, Nova, she's a chonk. She's a kitten on the cover. You get to see her tiny because that's the only way she's fitting in that suitcase. But it's always cool when you have those little Easter eggs of pieces of yourself inside your games.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. And I love knowing when people have an animal or, you know, whatever Easter egg in one of their designs. I love that.
Ooh, are you like me? So my Easter eggs, I try to hide in most of my games. It's not really that hard to hide things, but I tend to put like either gay stuff or like kind of dirty jokes. Those two are the ones that I tend to attach, if not like a friend or a family member or a cat. Those are like the themes that all slide into there. Like even National Geographic game, I put like a blue-footed booby because I think it's funny. And I put like a rainbow in the cover of it. Mm-hmm. So like the clue is rainbow colors. So I like to hide that stuff. Do you do anything like that?
I don't consciously. This is the first game where I've been like, okay, I definitely, but it's, you know, it's more obvious. It's the first game where I was like, I definitely want this in here.
That's so cool. Was that part of your contract or is that just something that came later?
No, I don't think it was in the contract, but it was something that I mentioned to them when we were finalizing stuff. It's like, hey, I would really like to have her on the cover. And they were like, oh yeah, no problem.
And you're like, you have tons of photos. We can make this work.
Yeah. So many photos.
That's so sweet. How do you feel like now that you've worked with quite a few publishers, do you have a preference towards being more or less involved in the process of the game once it's signed?
Generally, I kind of want to do whatever is best for the publisher, like whatever they want. I don't want to push to be more involved if they don't want me to be more involved. But I do like sort of having some say and having my hands in it a little bit on the way to publication. But I'm not offended either way, because I have always felt like when a publisher signs your game, it's their game now. So they get to decide, you know, what they want to do with it, essentially. And that's always been fine with me. I'm pretty chill. I feel like I'm pretty easygoing. So unless it's something that I would have a huge problem with, it's really not that big of a deal to me.
Okay. Yeah, I feel like a lot of designers have one or the other preference, but that's interesting to hear that you are just like, whatever they want, I am here if they need me. I mean, that's probably why you're getting a lot of games signed. If they look at me, they're like, oh, Danielle wants to get involved.
Oh, I mean, I don't know. I've always felt that way. It's like, well, they gave me money for this game and I signed it to them and it's part of their brand. Like, I want it to fit what they need it to be, not necessarily the vision that I had early on, and I have to keep it this way and it has to be pure and whatever. I want the publisher to feel like it fits their brand so they can change what they need to for that.
No, yeah, that totally makes sense. I mean, I think that is a great way to look at it. Otherwise, you'd self-publish. And I mean, you did try self-publishing, so maybe that's why you're so like, I'm good.
I did, yes. So I self-published Dinosaur Exhibit in 2022. I kickstarted it. I'm very glad that I did. I'm glad I had that experience and had to go through everything with manufacturing and just running a Kickstarter. Oh my goodness. And then shipping it myself afterwards. And I learned very quickly that I really don't want to do that. I much prefer the creative side of game design, and I really just want to make the games. I'm not really a business person. I don't feel like I have a business mindset in that way. And so, like I said, I'm glad that I did it. And I really did it because I wanted to have, it was my very first game, and I really wanted to have something that I could sort of point to and show publishers in the future. Like, look, I did. I made this thing. I designed it and I, you know, did the art direction and I kickstarted it and it's a thing. It's out in the world. 500 copies. So yeah, I'm glad I did it, but I never say never. But right now I have no plans of doing that again.
Yeah, that's totally fair. I feel very similar to exactly how you talked about it, except I did not actually end up finishing my Kickstarter, and I pulled it. I was like, oh no, we're too close to where it might barely fund. So that's great that you went through the full process. Even I didn't do that.
Yeah, like I said, it was very beneficial, and I'm glad that I did it, but it showed me a lot of things about what I do and don't want to do in the industry. So I know where I'm at now.
I'm sure also it just helps you kind of frame why a publisher maybe is taking longer, and like knowing all the pieces definitely helps see the full picture.
Yeah, to be patient with like, understanding why certain things take years to happen. I don't like to wait, but I can. It's fine.
Yeah, no, I was talking to a friend about how I look at signing games at this point, because I used to get so excited, but now I've had it where games have returned back to me, and like the first one was devastating. The second one, I was just like, I was bummed, but I wasn't surprised. And so just like realizing like, you know what, I'm gonna start looking at this kind of like when I back something on Kickstarter. I forget about it until it shows up.
You know what? That's a really great mindset, I think, because I learned early on with just waiting and then disappointment in things not getting signed and things falling through. It's like, well, if I have a bunch of projects that I'm working on at one time, the disappointments don't feel so bad because I'm always working on so many other things that have potential, or, you know.
Yeah. You almost distract yourself in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's sort of been a huge thing for me. It's like, all right, if I have enough stuff going, I can't think about the disappointments.
There you go. Yeah. I do the exact same thing. And I've had, gosh, probably like 4 or 5 almost contracts.
Mm-hmm.
Or it might even be more. I think it's more like 7, where the publisher is like, I'm sending you a contract. And then it either didn't get sent. They sent an initial one, but I had a bunch of notes, and then they never gave me a new one.
Oh, wow. I don't think I've had that experience yet where we were in negotiations and then it just didn't happen.
Yeah, no, I've even learned to stop celebrating that. One game, it was 3 of those instances was a single game, and then all the other ones were unique occurrences. I think it's 8 in total, which is just completely wild. So that was like potentially 8 games signed. Some of them found homes elsewhere. Some of them still don't have a home, which is like really sad.
Oh, I know. We can hang on to stuff for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I try not to think about it, but I'm like, oh, gosh, I don't understand this. Like, how did you go from we want to sign it, we want to like get this out next year, and then it's like nothing, crickets.
Yeah. And not hearing back at all is the hardest. Like, I can totally handle no's. Like, it happens all the time. But I would much rather have that closure of like, no, we're not interested. Okay, fine. I can move on from that. But to not hear anything is very hard.
I know for me, when I was the one receiving pitches, I always wanted to give someone an answer like in the moment and be like, hey, we're interested, but it needs these changes, or hey, we're not interested. Because I feel like I hated being left on the hook or not knowing how something went. I would rather tell someone. I love a no. A no is great because it's an answer.
Yeah. And I can totally appreciate where you were coming from when you were taking pitches, because like, tell me no right away. If you're not interested, that's fine. Like, I don't want to waste your time either.
Yeah. And I feel like on both sides, like, I'm more willing to pitch to someone who gave me an answer, and hopefully the publisher too is like, oh, if you took the no well or whatever I gave, more likely to receive pitches. It goes both ways.
Sure. Yeah. 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 Cause I think as a publisher, you want somebody who is fairly easy to work with, who will take feedback.
Yeah. And I think to your earlier point of putting out a game to show that you knew the process, I think even if they didn't know that it was self-published, knowing that you had a game under your belt meant that you probably were going to be easier to work with. Because I've talked to publishers where they're very scared to sign with new people because maybe they did try a new designer and it went poorly. And now they've kind of just assumed like the process itself is going to be too much, so they'd rather work with established designers, which is rough because then you don't get, you know, new names, new faces, new perspectives in as easily. You and I started from zero, and it's hard. It's really hard to break in. But once you have at least something signed or something out there, it does become significantly easier.
Yeah. And I think at the time, I didn't really realize how important it was to sort of have that out there. I wanted to sort of be working on something that I knew was going to see the light of day, which is why, you know, one of the reasons I moved forward with the Kickstarter and just doing it myself.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And random, going back to your game that we're talking about for Stable Times, you mentioned that horses, like people submitted them. I also saw that on the cards, it looked like there was flavor text and a name. Did they also submit flavor text? Or is that a mechanic?
Yeah. So every owner was asked to send in like a little blurb about the horse, or just some sort of personality characteristic or something about them. Every horse has its own little flavor text at the bottom. And then there is also a QR code in the rule book. So you can scan that and go to a website where they have the full stories, like everything that the owner sent in about that horse. And you can see pictures of the real horses.
That's so thoughtful. That is one of my favorite things about smaller companies. I feel like a big company won't do things like this, but like smaller ones will take the time because they know it matters and it means something. And it also, like, I don't know how many cards are in this game, but probably everyone who submitted their horse is going to buy a copy. So they can be like, look at my horse. Yeah. So like right there, 200 cards, 200 customers. Boom. Done.
I think it's 70 cards.
Okay. 70 customers. Still great.
Yes. Yeah. And then, you know, they end up buying them for family and friends too. Like, look, my horse is in this game. And I will shout out to Lovemore again, because they actually, some of my friends from my previous life when I was in horses submitted their horses. I think everyone who submitted and their horse was taken for a card, Lovemore actually sent them a copy of that card before the game came out in, you know, a really nice plastic display sleeve, and just sent it to each of the owners so they could have a copy of the card like for display. And I thought that was amazing. I remember one of my friends got it and she called me and was like, oh my gosh, they sent me this, a copy of my horse in this, and you know, it's in her office and it's great.
That is amazing. Yeah. I love those little touches it very time consuming little touch, but totally mattered to those people. And in my opinion, word of mouth is like one of the strongest forms of advertising. So if people are just raving and being like, oh, they sent me this and I bought the game, and like, you know, my mom paid for me to take these lessons as a kid, so I bought her the game. And then like she said, like, yeah, it just kind of like triggers this whole like rolling of, and then this person bought it, and then this person talked about it, and then this person made a video about it on their Instagram or whatever it is. It's great. I love it so much.
I was so, so thrilled with that. That was great.
Yeah. No, that's super special. Making me jealous. I want someone to do that. Now I also need to make a game where someone could do that. So yeah, actually, now that I think about it, a lot of my games wouldn't work for that. Have people been sending you horse pictures? Like, people send me caution signs?
Oh, no. Not really.
Maybe in the future? Question mark?
Maybe in the future. I'm happy to
receive unsolicited horse pictures.
Take a look. I know. Yeah.
That's so funny. That's like my friend Whitney, because she did charcuterie. The amount of people who send her pictures of charcuterie, she's like, I'm both happy and also, depending on the timing, sad, because if I'm hungry, it's really rough. And I was like, oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's rough. But cute.
But no, I'm happy if somebody wants to send me one. Like, I'm happy to get it.
Sweet. And then I guess, yeah, we've talked about a lot of really cool things for this game, but did you have like a favorite moment and a least favorite moment of the design journey specifically?
I would say probably one of my favorite moments was actually, I mean, it wasn't a moment, but taking it from the Starfish game into making it like a card game with the monster tattoos. I don't know. It felt like I had made something great from something that was not so great. That was kind of a big moment for me and kind of an aha moment. Even though this game exists on its own, I could change so much about it and make it into something new that's even better than it was before. And who knows, maybe I'll go back and try to make a Starfish Party game again. I don't know. I don't know if I have like a worst moment. I mean, playtesting sometimes has its own feel-bad moments for the designer. I can't think of any specific moment that was like, oh, that feels really bad. But it just, the general feel a lot of times, because I remember I took it to, we had a local protospiel that year, and I took it and I played it so many times with so many people that weekend. And I took it because I was local, so I was at home. So every night I would come home and I would redo every single card. And this isn't really answering your question that it wasn't a feel bad moment or anything. It was just, it ended up being a ton of work because I would come home at 11:30 or midnight and I would be like, okay, well, I got to change all these cards before I can go to sleep because I got to try this again in the morning. And so I think I remade it three times that weekend, like completely remade it three times that weekend, but ended up for the best, as it usually does.
No, that's great that you did that and you were able to do that, because I feel like it's really rough when you are like flying in for a unpub or a protospiel, you don't have access to that stuff. So it's a lot of like using whiteout or writing. Or if you're someone like me, I have so many games that I just move to a different game and I make all the changes when I get back home.
Okay, yeah. I knew that weekend that I wanted to like get it pretty finalized. So that was really one of the only games I think that I took that weekend. And so I was able to just focus on it.
Do you think it's better to focus on one game or have a mix when you go to something like a protospiel?
I think it's good to have a mix because I, like I said earlier, I like to have a lot of projects going at the same time. If I end up in a group of people and we are just sort of playtesting each other's games over and over again, I want to get more of my games, a larger variety of my games to the table.
Yeah, because you feel bad like being like, can we play this again? And everyone's like, unless it's a party game or like a light card game, I think people are more willing to do that a second time back to back or in the same night.
You know, I like to be very aware of my playtesters and I don't want them to feel like I'm wasting their time or it's like, oh, I just want to try this one little thing again and with this same game and make them play a whole other game of it. So yeah, I would prefer to have multiple different games.
That makes sense. And you also do solo designing and co-designing. Do you have a preference between the two? And if not, what do you like about each?
I don't really have a preference. I think when I am doing a solo design, I definitely have a type of game that I end up making, whether I set out to make that or not. It's just like a puzzly little family game, which is what generally most of my solo designs are. But I love co-designing, and I have acquired a lot of different co-designers over the last few years, and I love that experience because I feel like every person, I have something to learn from every person that I co-design with, and just, I feel like I'm pretty good at matching energies with my co-designers. Like, you know, depending on how they want to work, I can kind of adapt to that.
Yeah, I'm seeing a theme here. You're just like, whatever this person wants, I'll help. I'll do this. Chameleon.
We're getting personal. Like, I've been a people pleaser my whole life. And I turned 40 this year, and I'm really trying to sort of get away from that, making it the year of not caring what anybody thinks. But at the same time, you know, I like getting along with people, so I want to.
No, it's okay. I'm also a people pleaser, so I get it. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, I used to put other people ahead of me, or I'd always make like excuses for them, especially my dating life. That was always the case of like, oh, I really like this girl, but like she'd be in the closet and she'd just call me her friend. And then I'd be like, yeah, but it's so hard. But really, I was only hurting myself. I wasn't like, that wasn't good for me. So I understand. That's been like my past few years is just working on that kind of stuff too.
Yeah. And that has been a journey on its own, really trying to just stand up for myself and like do what I need to do. But anyway, with co-designing, it's just learning something from everyone. And I don't know, it's been great seeing different processes and different ways that other people design, how other people work. There's so much just to be learned from the nuance of that too, that I absolutely love it. And I end up working on a lot of different games with co-designers, things that I wouldn't think to work on my own. So it's really sort of helped stretch and my design skills and hone different things in the craft.
No, that's really cool. I know for me, every person I work with works at like different paces, or they like different programs more, or different roles are kind of assigned to one of us. And it's just figuring out like, how do we meet in the middle? How do we make this feel fair to both of us? Or if it's one where like I came with the idea and I had most of the game baked and they're more of a development role, like how does that look versus the opposite direction? They've built most of it. They need help with that last like 20%. And just like finding ways to work together that feel like good for both parties. I know for me, I've also tried quite a few different co-designers, and some people I work better with than others. Sometimes it's like you have too similar of styles. So it's like, well, we don't really need each other because we can do this on our own, versus you think super different than I think. So this actually works really well, even if we are almost arguing every time we have a playtest on what's better. I actually haven't had that in a while, but it has happened in the past.
Yeah, I think you have to sort of figure out that working relationship and like, okay, well, I want to do my fair share. My name's going on the box too, so I want to make sure I'm doing an equal amount of work, whatever it is that looks like.
Oh my God, yes, definitely. I mean, that's the same with like any form of relationship, a friendship, a partnership with like a romantic partner. We have a bucket of energy, but that energy isn't going to be put equally into every activity. Like, I mean, maybe we'll both take out the garbage, but more likely it's like, you do garbage, I'll do laundry, but you're doing dishes, or like, you're cleaning the dishes, I'm putting them away. And I mean, that's the same with co-designing. It's like, oh, I'm going to build the prototype, but like, maybe you're going to do more of the playtest, but I'm going to do more of the iterating on the design. So like, or you're at a convention, I get text messages from you of what needs to be changed. And then while you're at that show, I'm making those changes because I can't be there. And then send it off to you to print in the hotel. And then boom, you're trying out the next thing. It is a partnership.
Absolutely. And it can even change in the same co-design relationship from game to game. Like, okay, well, you did all the files this time, I'm going to do all the files this time. And
yeah, no, it's very interesting. Or it's like, just because I do have a graphics and more of an art background, I've still had co-designers that don't have that, but they still want to be in charge of the prototype. And I was like, you know, sure, works for me, because, you know, we have different ways of doing it. I use the Adobe suite and they use, oh my God, what is that? Like Nantech? Yeah. So it's like, okay, that's fine. Like, I'll create the little images that are going to end up being plugged into Nantech that you build the cards, because our cards are super complicated and it's actually faster for them to do it than me to do it. So it's like, okay, partnership.
Yep, absolutely. Everybody's got their own way of doing things too.
Yeah, I'm glad you've been having these fun, positive experiences in both solo and co-design. But do you have any other projects that fans should be looking out for in the future?
Ooh, I do have a few things that are coming out in 2026. So I have a game, actually a co-design with Andrew Stiles. Garden Club is coming out with Chris Couch Games. It's coming to Kickstarter early this year. I think maybe March of this year. And then I have a game with Smirk and Dagger, going to come out at some point this year. That's a co-design with Ammon Anderson. I'm super excited about that one. Oh my God.
Yeah, I didn't realize that's where it landed, if it's the one I'm thinking of. Okay, because I played it at the Gathering of Friends and it's great, so.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah. And I have a couple others, but I don't think I can talk about those yet. But yes, I do have a couple others that are coming out this year too.
That's so great. I'm glad that 2026 is going to be a hot year for you.
I hope so. I mean, yeah, I don't know. I'm looking forward to all the things that it can bring. So
no, I mean, you never know until the game's out how people are going to receive it. I know that for me, Tricky Kids that came out last year, I was so ready. I was like, yes, this game's coming out. It's one of the most unique things, or I think, in my opinion, it's the most unique design I have currently published. Uh-huh. Even though Caution Signs is great and it is unique, but Tricky Kids is more different than what was already out. And I was like, yes, this could be up for like a spiel or something. And it was funny because the publisher's like, yeah, the Germans don't get it. So, but the Italians love it. And I'm like, God damn it.
Sorry. It's done really well here, though.
Yeah, no, it's doing great in the States. And apparently Italians love it. The French enjoy it, haven't pulled the trigger. And so it's always interesting with like localization, like, oh, okay, so where is this going to vibe outside the States? Because I definitely do design with more North America in mind. Uh-huh. And so that was just such a funny comment. I was like, aw, man. And it was like emailed and both me and Steven are like, God damn it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. Yeah. So I was like, damn. All right. Caution signs. We really need to get you in German. Because like every designer, there's like specific awards that just to be nominated, I would be so freaking happy. And that was like one that I was like, okay, well, maybe there's a chance on this one. Nope, never mind.
We keep making stuff and keep working towards it.
Oh, for sure. Totally. And then for my last question, unrelated to the games you've designed, if you magically now have designed a game that was already out there, so you swapped your name with Monopoly's designer or whatever other, which game would you choose?
I'm glad you asked me this before so that I have an answer ready, because it totally would have stumped me. It would be Baron Park. I absolutely love that game. It's probably one of my most played games ever. And I had to pick a Phil Walker Harding game because he's one of my favorite designers. And I listened to the episode that you did with him and I loved it so much. Every game of his that I have played, I feel like he is just so good at distilling down to a single mechanism, and it is still so fun. And I love polyomino games, and I just feel like Baron Park, it feels different every time, and I would have loved to have made that one. I love it so much.
So, fun fact, the episode before this one, Reed also said the same exact answer. Turns out he's like one of the top players on Board Game Arena. So, if you want to go up against a different designer that was on the podcast for that game, that's so funny.
Okay. I do play a lot of it on BGA. Yeah.
Ooh. All right. I'll add myself and I'll lose. But you know what? It'll be fun.
It'll be awesome.
Hell yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much to everybody who's been listening to us. This was Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 135, Stable Times. And this was great having you on, Kristen. If you have like social media, is there anywhere you want to plug for people to find you in your games?
Sure. I'm on Facebook, Kristen Mott. And then I'm also on Instagram, which is where I typically post more of my game design related stuff. And it's at kristenmott.boardgaming. on Instagram.
Excellent. Yes, that is more where I have seen you.
Yeah.
Perfect. And then I've been your host. I'm Danielle Reynolds. If you're trying to find my personal social media, I got Instagram and Blue Sky under Token Gamer, and that's spelled G-A-Y-M-E-R. And then I started up these cool short form videos for Game Design Unboxed on Instagram and TikTok, and that's just under Game Design Unboxed. So I would highly recommend checking it out. It's only a minute commute. You listen to us talk for almost 50 minutes. I think you can do it. Yeah. And hopefully I'll get you on one of those videos too.
Sounds good. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, no, thanks for coming. This is great.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcasts.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out All Play at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.